Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Houman Majd, who was born in Iran and educated in Britain and the United States. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Ayatollah Begs to Differ, and The Ayatollah's Democracy. His latest book just out is The Ministry of Guidance Invites You to Not Stay, an American Family in Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Houman Majd.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And you've been in Geneva where the talks took place, and they seem to have gotten very close to an agreement. The Iranian press is blaming the French, as are a number of independent observers. There's been some tweeting coming back and forth from John Kerry and Iran's foreign minister, who they're both trying to sort of set the record straight of who's at fault here. But I understand, you know, the real issue here is the heavy water reactor at Iraq. Is that what you understand?
Yeah, well, that seems to have been the issue that the French brought up. I mean, I don't think anybody is doubting, even the American media, as well as I would say even the French themselves are doubting the story that they were very close to a deal. There was some form of a draft document that everyone was willing to sign, which is kind of why all the foreign ministers descended on Geneva on the second day. Because there was apparently an agreement, and that the French, when the French foreign minister walked into the hotel, he basically had, by that time, he had given an interview to a French radio saying that they weren't happy with the draft, and the draft was changed. Now, what the U.S. is saying now, apparently, is that they have all agreed on the French objections and have agreed to present a unified front to the Iranians. The Iranians were not happy, or I shouldn't say, I mean, I can't speak for them, but they seem to be uncomfortable with the changes that were made in the draft. And in those hours and hours and hours of negotiations, we're not able to close the gaps completely. So it was a disappointing end to the talks.
Well, of course, there were accusations in the Iranian press that France was carrying water for Israel. And there is, of course, a connection here in terms of Iran's Iraq heavy water reactor. It's pretty much identical to the Dimona reactor that is the source of Israel's plutonium for all of its very sophisticated nuclear arsenal. I guess, you know, what we're talking about here is there's an obvious double standard. Israel has perhaps 200 very sophisticated thermonuclear weapons, including neutron bombs, and Iran has the same reactor and can't cross the threshold, and that's the deal. So my understanding...
Well, I wouldn't put it in quite that way. I think the first thing one has to remember is, and based on Netanyahu's own statements, there was no deal that was about to come out of Geneva that would have been satisfactory for the Israeli side. And I think Iraq is a little bit of a red herring. It's not completed yet. By all estimates, it will be at best completed by the end of 2014. And we should also remember that this deal that was supposed to be signed was not supposed to be a comprehensive deal that puts an end to the nuclear issue and all the sanctions are lifted and everyone goes about their way happily and merrily. It was going to be the first step in what was to be a comprehensive agreement. Many other things were going to be negotiated later on. As the Iranians have said and the Americans agreed back in September with the UN General Assembly meetings here in New York, that they would start out with this sort of step-by-step negotiations where there would be an interim, a first step, which would stop, let's say, the progress on the Iranian nuclear program, and then other things would be worked out. So the idea that Iraq, the heavy water reactor, needed to be stopped now doesn't make a lot of sense. It seems that there are other issues that Israel was concerned with. It seems that short of, at least this is the position that Israel is taking right now, short of a complete surrender on Iran's part, in other words, completely giving up enrichment, completely dismantling the centrifuges and everything else that America has sort of, you know, tacitly agreed they can have on some level with a heavy inspection regime. Short of that, the Israelis are not going to be happy. So Iraq became a good excuse, in my opinion. That's the way I see it. But it could not have possibly been the reason to break this deal or to not sign this deal, just because of the time frame. the fact that it's not even completed by the end of 2014. And even when it's completed, that's when nuclear material may or may not be introduced to it. So it didn't make sense for this interim deal to fall apart on the basis of the heavy water reactor.
And again, I'm speaking with Houman Majd, who was born in Iran and educated in Britain and the United States. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Ayatollah Begs to Differ, and The Ayatollah's Democracy. His latest book just out is The Ministry of Guidance Invites You to Not Stay, an American Family in Iran. So, and of course, not to beat a dead horse here, my understanding of the Israeli position is that obviously there is a double standard. They have the Dimona reactor that's been the source of all their plutonium for their very mature and deliverable arsenal. And
yes,
there's no evidence that Iran has crossed the nuclear threshold. And most observers seem to think that they want to be nuclear capable like the Japanese are in terms of a weapon, but not necessarily cross that threshold. But from the Israeli point of view, my understanding is that the minute that they will take that reactor out before it goes hot, because obviously just as they did with the Iraqi one. So it seems to me that maybe there is more to it, and maybe the Western powers recognize that Israel's threat's not a bluff.
Yeah, well, I think that the Israelis probably would try to take out the reactor if it continues, or if it gets close to completion, close to the point where within weeks or a couple of months, nuclear material could be introduced to it, and then they can't take it out then because of the radioactive fallout. Yes, but again, we're talking about a time frame which is probably at this point almost a year away. So there's no, it sort of doesn't make sense that an interim agreement that was only supposed to be temporary until they can, which would stop a lot of the progress that Iran has made on its nuclear program. If it doesn't actually stop the centrifuge spinning, it actually we haven't seen the document. We don't know exactly what's in the deal, but certainly they would not be adding to their stockpile right now, which is something that they are doing while we don't have a deal. And so I think that it still doesn't make sense that, you know, the Western powers are afraid that Israel is going to act on its own and go and bomb the Iraq facility. It doesn't make sense to say, well, stop the Iraq facility now when we are actually more than a year away at this point of it being, you know, presenting any sort of danger whatsoever. That's why I'm calling it a red herring. That's why I think that Israel probably just doesn't want Iran to ever be nuclear capable, as you said, because then it becomes a power in the Middle East, in the region, that is opposed to Israeli policies and opposed to Israeli, certainly towards the Palestinians, but in general, the Israeli power in the Middle East. And a nuclear-capable Iran then becomes a much more powerful regional adversary. So I think that's really what it boils down to. Again, this is my opinion.
Doesn't mean
that I know what the Israelis are thinking, but it just appears that way. It appears that the Israelis just do not want Iran in a position to ever challenge their superiority military and economically in the Middle East.
Well, but we do have this paradox now where Israel and Saudi Arabia in many ways are on the same page vis-a-vis the military coup in Egypt, and in their mutual concerns about Iran.
Yes.
And I don't think it's a stretch to suggest that we already have, in effect, the Sunni bomb with the world's fastest growing nuclear arsenal in Pakistan, that if Iran were to get a bomb, I don't think it would be a stretch to assume that the Saudis would buy one from the Pakistanis.
If they haven't already.
If they haven't already, exactly, yes.
Yeah, if they haven't already, or I mean, I don't think they even have to transfer a weapon and a missile to the peninsula. I think they can probably have the control inside Pakistan to launch one if they needed to. And certainly Pakistan neighbors Iran, so they can always threaten Iran with a Pakistani bomb, one assumes.
Right. Let's get off this subject. Not that it's not important, albeit a bleak one, but there's a certain, I guess, surreal humor to your book, which was one of the reasons I was calling you about. The Ministry of Guidance invites you to not stay an American family in Iran, and you took your blonde, blue-eyed, Midwestern yoga instructor wife along with your child to Iran in 2011, and you get to the airport, and of course the intelligence people pull you over and present you with this huge dossier that they have on you, and they stay in touch with you throughout your stay. And obviously you had reasons to be concerned because there was the British embassy riots and various so-called American spies have been arrested. So give us a sense of this strange theocratic authoritarian regime that seems to be very much in charge, but not necessarily very popular.
Yeah, well, it's certainly not very popular. It's impossible. Polling is not accurate in Iran. There's no question that the regime has support among the people and generally among the working classes and among the poorer elements in society who have been, well taken care of by the regime. And in rural areas where people have gotten zero interest loans and so on and so forth. But in general, there are many policies of this regime that are not popular. And, the freedom of the press, the repression of journalists, repression of political activists, political prisoners in Iran. I say that, and at the same time, it's not quite a police state the way North Korea is or even Cuba is, and you don't sense it. I mean, it's somewhat different in that I have somewhat of a public profile, and they know my writings, and I appear on television in America, and they see that. They see CNN, they see MSNBC, they see various shows and radio shows, and so anybody who has a public profile and who speaks about politics and Iranian politics in particular is going to have a file at the Ministry of Intelligence in Iran. Whether they trust you or not, they're going to have a file on you. And there are going to be things that one writes if you don't self-censor yourself too much. There are going to be things that you write that they're not going to like. But that said, most people in Iran are just trying to get along with their lives. And politics is important to them. Because in this particular case, now with the nuclear issue, politics very much affects their pocketbooks, the sanctions, I mean, at least in terms of sanctions, and the economy. The economy is very much tied to what happens internationally, so foreign relations become very important. So they are interested in politics. And, of course, we saw in 2009 how interested they were in politics and how they came out and protested what they believed was a fraudulent vote. But we also saw in 2013, this year, we saw how people did participate in the election. They didn't boycott it. They thought they had a serious choice between someone like Rouhani, who was elected, and someone like Jalili, who represented a continuation of the Ahmadinejad years. And they clearly made a decision. They wanted a different tack. They wanted a different form of government, a different kind of government, I should say, rather than a different form of government, that was going to be much more moderate, that was going to ease up a little bit on some of the heavy restrictions that were in place. And in 2011, when I was there, it was probably one of the worst years in terms of repression and in terms of the inability of civil society to act at all. So I think that the paradox of Iran is that there's this continual back and forth. And certainly now we're at a stage where Iranians have who live inside Iran. I mean, and the diaspora is always going to have different opinions. And there are certain people who want, the regime completely overthrown. And there are others who support Iranians inside Iran who want gradual change. But it is a country where the revolution is not quite mature. People haven't quite figured out what it is that they want in terms of a form of democracy. Because what people mostly do agree is that the Western liberal democracy is not going to work in Iran. A Western liberal democracy is not going to work. Not that people don't want it, or some people don't want it, but because there is this huge, very conservative segment of the population that doesn't want it. So what does an Islamic democracy look like? And that's the problem in Iran, and that's the problem that surfaced in 2009. It's a problem that was addressed to some degree in 2013 in the landslide victory of Rouhani, who is promising a different kind of Islamic democracy than the hardliners are, and more similar to what Khatami had promised in the before Ahmadinejad, but was unable to deliver. And I think Iranians are kind of like just waiting to see if this will ever mature into a real form of democracy that may not be exactly like our democracy. It will have an Islamic tint to it because, as I said, there is a large segment of the population that still wants Islam to be part of the public sphere. the public politics of Iran. So I think it's still it's this place that has all these paradoxes and has all these issues that some of which I bring up in my book.
Indeed, you do talk about the anniversary, the second anniversary of the 2009 Green Movement, which resulted in a number of Iranian protesters being killed. It was nothing like Tahrir Square or what's happening in Egypt today. And you make the point that the regime would rather jail its opponents than slaughter them publicly. And to your earlier point, of course, we do have a democracy here that also has a component, the religious right, and the Christian Reconstructionists, like, for example, Senator Ted Cruz's father, who want an Iranian regime here in the United States.
Absolutely. And their views have to be taken into account. I mean, if you look at someone like Mitt Romney running in 2008 against President Obama, I mean, he had to veer hard right in order to win the nomination, the Republican Party. So, you know, there are things that have to be taken into account in both societies. It is different. I'm not trying to equate the two societies and the two political systems, because Iran does have a supreme leader who can put his foot down and say, well, this is the way it's going to be. And we don't have that here. But there is politics in Iran. A lot of people imagine in the dictatorship there's no politics. The dictator just says what's going to happen, and the minutiae of everyone's, the details of government, the minutiae of every policy are handled by this one dictator, and with no reference whatsoever to any opposition or any different views. And that's just not the case in Iran. So it is a more vibrant political system. That said, it's not quite the democratic utopia that some Iranians who are pro-regime claim it is.
So, Humam Maj, you brought up the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and Reuters have just completed a 6-month investigation into his finances. They say he has a business empire worth US$95 billion, which is more than the Iran's current annual petroleum exports. And this operates through a foundation called Setad, and they've seized all of these properties from Iranians, exiles, and other minorities. And it was originally set up by Ayatollah Khomeini to create a foundation to help the poor and the war veterans, but it's morphed into this massive economic empire, which gives Khamenei even more power, in the sense that he's got both political, theocratic, and economic clout. So a lot of the diaspora, and here I'm talking to you from what we jokingly refer to as Tehrangeles.
And
as you know, there's a range of opinions from the exile diaspora, from the royalists to the communists. But what I hear a lot is that the theocrats, the Ayatollahs, just sort of moved into the mansions of the Shah's cronies in North Tehran. And if this Reuters report is the same, it sounds like, in terms of private wealth, not that he's necessarily being ostentatious about it like the Shah was, but it does look as if the Ayatollah, the supreme leader, is a Shah in that respect, in terms of his wealth.
You could look at it that way, absolutely. And it's true that after the revolution, a number of people who fled Iran, their homes were confiscated. And in some cases, some of the new regime moved into those homes. In some cases, and in fact, quite a few cases, those homes were torn down and buildings were built there that became government buildings. Or in a couple of cases, in a few cases, schools or hospitals, or schools especially, and foundations were built there. But it is different in that the only way I would say it's different is that, apart from what you mentioned, the fact that the supreme leader does not live an ostentatious lifestyle, and actually very, very few people who are directly in the government or in the regime do. In fact, I don't know of any who live that kind of ostentatious lifestyle. It's also they don't spend a huge amount of money on stuff that isn't on a personally ostentatious. For example, you know, Iranian government officials, you know, don't go around in like incredible limousines and helicopters and stuff like that. They tend to be a lot more low key. But it is also true. So it's hard to say how much of that money is personal wealth and how much of it is, as you say, this foundation that it's supposed to be helping the poor and it's supposed to be helping mosques and churches and stuff like that. It's hard to say, first of all, what the exact number is. And I've looked at the Reuters report, but I don't know, you know, the absolute accuracy of every dollar amount. But let's, for sake of argument, say it is true. It's not clear that all that money is being kept for the personal use of the Supreme Leader. This is not to defend it. It's just to say that it's not clear to me, in the way that the Shah may have had certain, you know, grandiose plans that he would spend some of the state's money on, but also there was tremendous amount of personal wealth, you know, 100 cars, you know, from Ferraris to Bugattis in the Shah's palace and stuff like that, the way the palace was decorated and stuff like that. So in that sense, it's not quite like a Shah, and I think they're very aware of that. They're very aware of the fact that if they were ever to act that way, the Ayatollahs, they would lose whatever popularity they do have among, and the popularity is among the working class and the poor and the downtrodden. So I think that they're careful not to do that. But again, as I said, I'm not sure, you know, how the Supreme Leader spends any of his money or intends to spend any of his money or to give it away to his kids or whatever else. I'm not sure that that can happen.
Well, Humam Raj, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Humam Raj, who was born in Iran and educated in Britain and the United States. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Ayatollah Begs to Differ, and The Ayatollah's Democracy. His latest book just out is The Ministry of Guidance Invites You to Not Stay, an American Family in Iran. This is Beam Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Colin Black. This program is available for podcast at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Time.